This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Front One.
The Majority Report. With Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, September 5th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to talk about his upcoming cover story in Rolling Stone magazine, Matt Taibbi, on just how despicable Mitt Romney is. We may tie that into the first night of the DNC last night. I don't know if you watched it. My daughter watched some of it. Interesting perspective. Most of the men who spoke, she saw about three or four guys. And the women, she thought the men all looked very nice. She said, like, she kept saying, like, he looks nice. And I got to say, during the Republican primary, she watched the debates, and she said the only people that she liked were Romney and Santorum. Now, so just visually, she's giving a sense. She liked Santorum because she felt like he was a family man, and she liked Romney because she appreciated how cutthroat he was in business.
She said that?
Yeah. She said, I like a guy who is not so sentimental when it comes to business, because the business of business is to make money. And if you get caught up in sentiment, you may not make the moves that are necessary to make in the context of business. And she also just liked his hair. Those are the two things that she said that she liked. We will speak more about the convention as the program goes on. I have basically two sets of ways in which I analyze the convention. One is the sort of horse racy one, which is really what the convention is in some respects. I mean, in most respects, it's an advertisement. It's also a pep rally. And then in the substance, my emo prog side, as they say. We will talk about that. We'll also talk about that maybe a little bit with Matt Taibbi. Also, that very wealthy woman, the billionaire from Australia, the woman who was chastising people. You know, like, there's no monopoly on being a millionaire. You could just work harder, drink less. Of course, she also, the way that she made her money was to inherit it. She has some interesting comments. Also, more on the grand bargain watch and on the implications of the debt and deficit. We will talk about that later in the program. We may get to the lack of charges for the CIA and their torture regime. That story's not going to go away. There's a couple interesting takes online about how sometimes it takes a generation or so before a country can really sort of begin to deal with some of the horrible things that they have done. We will get into that as the program continues. But one note, we have a new sponsor of this program. We'll not burden the members with these ads, but we will start to insert these ads as we go on. Although I would encourage members to check it out too, because, you know, the Audible ads that we do, you know, they come from a server service, and online books, I'm value neutral in my mind. I don't think they're bad things. I don't think they're particularly progressive things, but I think they're things that people would enjoy. But when we have a sponsor for the show like JustCoffee.coop or this next sponsor, I want a company that actually is sort of reflective of our values. It doesn't mean that, you know, they're stuff that I would necessarily use, because in this instance, it would be inappropriate for me to use this. This service, but because they are fans of the show, or because they've been, they're running their business in such a way that is sort of an extension of our values here. And so, I got an email from a guy who started up a business called Strange Angels at strangeangels.com. It's a progressive, essentially online dating service, which is why it would be somewhat inappropriate for me to use, at least without checking with my wife first. And probably, I don't know if there is a section where it would be appropriate for, you know, for married people. I have a feeling probably not. But they really, they're fans of the show. They appreciate the show. They want to help the show survive. And so they came up with a very good idea for them. And what they want to do to promote the launching of their site, strangeangels.com, they said, we will sponsor 50 free one-month trial memberships to the Majority Report as a way of helping entice people who aren't sure they want to become a member. Now, again, you know, it's just about supporting the show, but you get that bonus of the extra 50 minutes at the end of the show. And so that's what it is. You can email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We're going to take the first 50 people. majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put into the subject line Strange Angels, or strangeangels.com, free trial if you want as well, but the word strangeangels.com into our the subject line at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll set you up with a one-month free trial membership as a way of Strange Angels saying, come check out our page. So, you know, I'm not going to talk about this in the body of the show. Maybe I'll mention once or twice more over the course of but, you know, we'll put in some ads into the free show, obviously. But there it is. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Matt Taibbi. Later in the program, I'll go over the platform as part of my grand bargain watch, and also a lament on a couple other things, and I'll give my feelings on the convention itself. It was a rousing success on one hand, and on another hand, it is still sort of the same Democrats in some respects that I have some frustration with. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Taibbi on just how horrible Mitt Romney is. I mean, not just like he's he's stilted and not human, but all the bad things he does. All right, we'll be right back.
Everybody's coming home for lunch these days.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering our listeners of The Majority Report a free audiobook that you can download now at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Why not pick up one of Matt Taibbi's books? Griftopia is available there, and so isn't The Great Derangement. Griftopia, The Great Derangement, get either one of those for free at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Pick it up right now. It helps you, it helps me, it helps them. It helps Taibbi.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
What it was, what it was.
Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Had a dream last night about you, my friend. Had a dream I wanted to sleep. Plastic. Had a dream I wanted to lick your knees. Had a dream it was about nothing. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling.
We are back on the Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Matt Taibbi. Matt, are you there?
Sam. Sorry about that.
Well, no. Most people,
I thought somebody else was calling me, and
what do you do? You hide in the phone. That's why I tried to call you. Had left a message on your cell earlier, like 20 minutes ago, to give you a heads up. Didn't work.
Yeah, I don't have any excuse.
I can only imagine what goes on there. It's always like what you're like who you who is it you're running from. Matt Taibbi, we're going to blow the lid off this thing. You know, it's very hard to stay under the radar when you have a when you have your name splashed all over the Rolling Stone magazine.
It's just I just like to, you know, disappear every now and then, and I completely forgot that I wasn't supposed to at this time.
So. All right. Well, so let me. I don't know if you saw the Democratic convention. And if you did, we can talk about it a little bit. For me, it's a little bit hard watching it because the thing that I'm really juiced about is voting against the Republicans.
Right.
You know,
right.
In 2008, I think I was a little bit more my motivation was a little bit more in favor of something rather than specifically against something. I am firmly entrenched in voting against something this year. And the piece that you wrote on Mitt Romney, I was hoping was going to be the sort of the narrative of the Obama campaign. It doesn't appear like it's going to be. But let's talk about this, because the story you tell of Mitt Romney, entitled "The True Story of Mitt Romney and Bain Capital," is really, in many respects, reflective of the story of the financialization of our economy, which has been so problematic for just about everybody except for, I don't know, several thousand families. Yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Tell us about the true story of Mitt Romney.
Well, yeah, just like you say, it's this is really about a change in the way that Wall Street did business and big business did business in America. In the old days, the American economy was really powered by, you know, it was an industrial economy that was really based around our gigantic manufacturing capacity. We had these huge factories, especially in the Rust Belt, that built everything. And we had massive corporations that built things, exported them around the world, and they were the real powers in American business. And then that started to change in the 80s when a lot of these financial engineers, specifically guys like Mike Milken and Ivan Boesky, they started to figure out ways to organize massive amounts of capital in really short periods of time, and that allowed them to make game-changing financial transactions without having built anything or having a real business behind them as collateral. So it really became more, what became more important was your ability to raise capital as opposed to your ability to make stuff. And Mitt Romney was really at the forefront of that, of all those changes. His company, Bain Capital, was one of the pioneers of this whole revolution where companies just, they raised capital, took over existing companies, liquidated them for their assets, or took value out some other way, and then moved on. So we moved from a society that built stuff to a society that that made financial products.
All right. So now we should distinguish. You distinguish in the piece that Bain Capital basically had two different businesses. One was sort of providing venture capital, sort of seeding small businesses, seeding businesses so that they would grow. And at one point, Bain and certainly Romney saw this as almost not too risky in some respects. Like, you know, some
right.
companies are going to exist, some companies are going to fail. And so they came up with this other, what you've just described, this other sort of leverage buyout formula. So take us through how this works, because this is the part, you know, when
most people just don't get this part because it's
right.
so counterintuitive.
It's so counterintuitive. And Newt Gingrich, bless his heart, made it very clear what this was. It's vulture capitalism. And
right.
I don't even think people realize how little risk there is for a guy like Romney in this situation. It's almost impossible for Bain in these instances to lose money. So explain what they would do.
So the way this works is if you're a company like Bain and you want to take over an existing company, let's say it's KB Toys, you go out and you raise a bunch of money ahead of time. Mainly, you put down a little bit of your own money. It's kind of like buying a subprime mortgage. You might put down 5 or 10% at most. And then you go out and you finance the rest. You borrow, let's say the company's worth $500 million, you borrow $300 million of it to buy a controlling stake. And you do that by borrowing against the assets of a company you don't own yet. So when you go to a bank like Citigroup or JP Morgan Chase or Goldman, and you say, I want $300 million. Can you find the investors who will get that money for me? We're going to take over KB Toys. It's not your own collateral that you're posting to get that loan. It's the collateral of KB Toys that you're posting. So you're promising to take over a company and deliver that company's assets as collateral. So you do that, you get the loan, then you buy it.
I just want to draw this out so the people understand. This is in some respects very much like a sort of almost like, I guess, a mortgage in some respects, right? I put down 10%.
It's exactly like a mortgage, yeah.
It's a million-dollar house. I put down 10%, $100,000, and I say to the bank, you've assessed this house. It's worth $1 million. I've put $100,000 down, so there's an extra $100,000 padding essentially, and you essentially own the house if I don't make these payments, and
right.
that's what
except that it's somebody else's house. That's the only distinction.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I'm not going to be living in this house, incidentally.
Right.
I've let the owners stay in there, and they think they're still in that house, basically.
Right.
And they're counting
right.
on living in that house. And so, all right. So go ahead. So they get this loan. They'll get 90% of the financing from an investment house, or, some other entity, and then right. What happens?
And they call that. This is so funny. This is a funny detail. They call that financing dry powder. that's such a funny term, because it's like a piracy thing. Then when they raise that money, they typically raise that money before they even know what the target is. So they go out and they get the loan. Then what you're promising to take over somebody,
right.
and then you go out with that dry powder. You identify a company that typically they have a good cash flow, but they're poorly organized or there's some other problem. You take over the company. Then there's two different ways it goes. One can be a hostile takeover where the company doesn't want to be bought out. Bain didn't do any of those. Or the other way, which is where they go to the management and they say, look, we're going to pay each of you, you know, $5 million, the top 10 managers in the company. Then you're going to go along with whatever decision we make. And then they basically just use the company as an ATM machine from that point forward. Now they own the company. They can do whatever they want with it. If the company has any credit at all, they just start going out and taking out loans and paying themselves bonuses with it.
Now they pay themselves bonuses because we're doing these management consultation. And,
right.
And the thing that people have to understand is this is a company that was not necessarily in danger of going under. There was no reason to believe that this was a company in distress, right? I mean, this is just a company where they perceived they could maximize its potential, but not one which was imminently going out of business.
Right. No, you wouldn't buy it if it was unless there was some kind of mismatch situation with its assets and real estate being undervalued. You wouldn't buy a company that was going to go out of business right away anyway.
And this company that's chugging along doing okay all of a sudden has literally hundreds of millions of dollars of new debt, which didn't go towards buying new machines or opening up new markets. It just went towards allowing Bain to own them.
Yeah. right. Yeah, actually, they typically end up with three gigantic new obligations. One is the bank debt, right, which is – you know, it could be $300 million. It's an enormous sum of money. The second is the management fee. So you get the bank debt, and then suddenly you can't afford to keep all your workers anymore. So Bain Capital tells you who to fire. And for the service of telling you who to fire, you have to pay them like $5 million a year or whatever it is, or $10 million. And then the third thing is sometimes that's not enough. And the investors and Bain, they say, we'd like some more money. It's like that Beavis and Butthead thing, you know, can you like give us more money? You know, they ask the leaders of the company to go out and they do, either they issue a dividend or they just take out a bank loan. And, you know, in the case of KB Toys, for instance, they did a $120 million quote unquote dividend recapitalization where they issued a dividend. They borrowed like $80 million in bank loans. Then they issued, you know, another $40 million in stock, and they just paid that money to Mitt Romney and his investors. So it's just like a one-time, like, we own you, we'll take this fee. so you know, if before they came into the picture, you didn't have $300 million in bank debt, you didn't have the $5 million in management fees, and then you didn't have this $120 million dividend recapitalization. Now you got to get over all of that just to get back to square one, and, you know, be operating as a business.
Now, we should say that in the numbers that you're talking about, when, you know, we're talking general numbers here, but the skin in the game, as we like to hear from Bain at this point, is $5 million. Right? I mean, approximately.
Well, Ampad was five. Yeah. KB was like $18 million, but they took that out. Back out of the company in like 5 minutes. I mean,
and so, I think people are just sort of it's almost impossible to wrap your head around this thing because it is exactly what essentially the mafia would do with you know, like in The Sopranos. You mentioned The Sopranos in your piece just briefly, but it's exactly what happened to the early in The Sopranos with the guy with the sporting goods store.
Yep. Or Goodfellas with the restaurant.
Yeah.
you know, there's that great scene in Goodfellas, which to me, like, epitomizes exactly what private equity is all about, where they take over the restaurant, and then Paulie, the mobster, starts running up. He starts buying all this liquor on credit. And you know, the narration in the movie is like, you buy a case of you know, whiskey for $200 through the front door, you sell it out the back door for $100, and it doesn't matter. It's all profit, you know. Even though you're taking you're theoretically taking a loss, it's the company that's taking the loss, and you're just getting $100.
Right.
And that's what happens with these companies. Is it smart for KB Toys while it's going through a hard time to take out an $80 million loan so that it can pay bank loan so that it can pay a dividend to Mitt Romney? Of course not. It's idiotic, but it's $80 million in profit for Mitt Romney.
KB goes out of business, right? Or, you know, literally in this case, but also as functioning as our model. It goes out of business. So how now do they just sell off all their assets so they pay off the original loan? I mean, is that the first creditor that's in line there? Because why would people continue to give loan money to Bain to go
right.
out and do this corporate rating if these companies end up bankrupt?
They typically end up getting just enough. You know, what one person described it to me as, you have a patient. It's almost like the patient's going to die tomorrow, but you keep him alive for 4 years just to get enough, to suck enough blood out of him to make the transaction worthwhile. And that's kind of what ends up happening with these companies. They keep him alive by hook or crook long enough for everybody to get paid off. And, you know, like in KB's case, it was in business for 4 years before it went into bankruptcy. And its investors ended up making money on the deal. Bain ended up making, you know, like a 600% profit on the deal. But they, you know, if it's not inconceivable. A lot of these companies do manage to stay functional for a long time. And, you know, they get their debt service paid and then, but eventually they do go bankrupt and, you know, it's not a good eventuality for the company, but the investors almost always get paid off.
It's just, I mean, I think, you know, just, I just don't think people understand that enough. And, you know, because we hear so much about it's creative destruction. What is that even supposed to mean? I mean, I get the idea that, like, well, there's some fat in the industry, but if the company is functioning, maybe
right.
there aren't a slew of investors who are making hand over fist money, but it is the owners of the company are making money, the workers are making money, the product continues to be put out. Is anybody done any numbers on this supposed creative destruction that we keep hearing about, which is why these entities are so good for the economy?
I think it's such an esoteric, it's such a difficult thing to quantify that they're not ever at risk of anybody ever doing it. I mean, they've tried to quantify whether or not private equity is a good investment for investors, and from what I understand, it's about average. If you were an investor and you just dumped your money into a mutual fund that, you know, that just was indexed to the Standard and Poor index or the NYSE, you'd probably make about as much money as you'd make investing in Bain Capital. But Bain makes, you know, a fortune. But as far as the creative destruction goes and what the benefit is to society for, you know, Mitt Romney to go in and wreck a bunch of companies and take $250 million out and stash it in a Cayman Islands bank account, I have no idea how you could quantify that. I don't think they'll ever be able to, which is a good thing for Mitt Romney, because I doubt that would turn out to be a positive thing. It just can't be. Because even on a micro level, if you look at these deals, so many of the decisions that companies like Bain make are so incredibly counterintuitive. They're just the last thing that a good business person would do. You know, if you're having a tough time, and your company is kind of trying to ride out a storm, the last thing you want to do is pay your CEO an $18 million bonus, pay, you know, your 10th vice president a $4 million bonus or whatever it is. But this is what Bain Capital has to do to get these people on board to make all these decisions. They have to pay them these lavish bonuses. And that's completely – it's just bad business, you know, in addition to being corrupt and crazy. It's just not smart. You want to tighten your belt, not be extravagant at those times.
Right. And it's not even – you know, it's one thing to take on debt to as an investment in your future. But
right.
This is just like literally like all you're getting is the debt. You're not seeing any – there's absolutely zero assets that comes with that debt. I mean, even when I take a loan out on a house, I get some equity in the sense that I can live in the house. Like I get – you know,
right.
And from this house, because I'm living in this house, it's easier for me to go get a job, and I'm now in a school district, and I can send my kid to the school. But this is as if basically like – you're saddled with the mortgage, but you're already living in the house. And it's just like all of a sudden,
right.
I've got my house is paid off. Well, guess what? I now own the house and you are now paying off the mortgage. Good luck with that.
Right, right, right. Yeah, no, what you get for your $300 million investment is the privilege of being managed by Mitt Romney, you know?
Right, or a payoff.
Or
you know,
the Carlyle
payoff.
Group.
Yeah,
right.
It's basically just like if you're in the management, you just get a payoff. Otherwise, it was a hostile takeover, and that's the end of it. I mean, it seems to me that Newt Gingrich, and this is what's been so frustrating for me and continues to be frustrating. We're only one night into the, and we haven't heard the debates, and, you know, and I'm sure there's some ads playing in Ohio somewhere, but there was a real opportunity that Newt Gingrich – and I can't believe these words are coming out of my mouth, gave the country. they gave the country insofar as, like, you could get a lesson in what is one of the, in my estimation, one of the most problematic aspects of what has happened in this country in the past 30 years, which is the financialization of basically companies being turned into financial instruments via this process, via the idea of you pay CEOs and board of directors compensation in the form of stock options, which encourages them to do very similar things as to what Bain
right.
comes in and does. Because right. they just cut workers, don't think about the long-term health of the company or the community, for that matter, and they pay off. And it's this financialization of our economy, which I think is responsible ultimately for so much of this. And one of the things that you mentioned, and we incentivize the stock options as a compensation by lowering capital gains under income so that it makes
right.
more sense for CEOs to be paid that way. And apparently, we do the same thing with this leverage buyout stuff. Explain that part of it.
Yeah, the interest that the companies have to pay on the debt service, all that great new debt service that you have to pay when you get taken over, that's tax deductible. So the government's actually encouraging these sorts of takeovers. And most of these deals, and I talked to the former chief accountant of the SEC, who used to work for a Big Four accounting firm, and looked at a lot of these deals. And he said these deals basically would never go through without that deduction. It just wouldn't make enough economic sense. So this whole practice of leverage buyouts wouldn't be possible without the tax code being written the way it is. So it encourages it has this incredibly negative consequence of encouraging people to invest in debt rather than equity. So, rather than having all those rich Americans and companies with excess liquidity lying around investing in the stock market and investing in the healthy companies, instead you invest in this, which just adds to the overall indebtedness of the country, and it's a bad thing. It's a negative thing.
It's really stunning. And then, of course, when Romney walks away with his money, best case scenario, according to him, or if, you know, from the perspective of the country, is that he pays 13.9% in taxes on it.
Right, right, which is totally, quote-unquote, legal and fair, right? Is that what he said? I think, yeah. It's because the way they tax the income of private equity guys, as they call it, carried interest. So that's a maximum rate of 15%. So in a good year, Mitt Romney will pay, you know, somewhere close to 15% in taxes. But I suspect the reason that he hasn't released his other returns is that in most years he pays probably far less than that. So
yeah, supposedly there's a story out today. I don't know if it's accurate or not, but supposedly somebody's somehow managed to hack into his full 2010, I think it was, taxes. I don't know if it's true or not. I think they're trying to actually sort of hold it for ransom to see if they can make money, which in some way really squares the circle, doesn't it?
exactly. Blackmail being the other part of the business model. Yeah, exactly.
And the thing is that you really outline in your piece that Mitt Romney's, that this is, you know, talk for a moment about what, because you say that Mitt Romney has sort of been shadowing all of this sort of financial innovation, I guess, over the past 30 years, and that it is indicative of there's something to be gleaned from who he is as a person, just that he decided to do this, because you make the point that or somebody, I guess, somebody who graduated with him, that this guy came out of Harvard with a law degree and a business degree. And
right.
Obviously came from an amazing pedigree. His father was chairman of a major car company and governor of Michigan. And
a presidential candidate.
And nearly the nominee.
Right.
I mean, this guy could have done anything, but he went into essentially the... I guess, I mean, how would you, because you set up a distinction between the sort of the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the sort of the days of old, these, you know,
right.
robber barons. At least they would sort of put their mark on the country in some way.
Yeah, exactly. Even his dad, you know,
right.
his dad was, you know, George Romney. He ran American Motors Cars. He was, you know, for whatever you might think of his politics, he was very, you know, deeply concerned with the community that his company operated in. He was almost obsessed with the problems of inner city Detroit,
yeah.
And that's what led him into politics. He was really troubled by the world that was going on around his factories, and what's so interesting about what Mitt chose to do is that it's the exact opposite of what his dad did. He really pioneered a way for people in his position to own companies without having any of the responsibility that any of these people used to have toward the communities that they lived in. And these guys, you know, the Carnegies and the Hersheys and you know, the people who, the Rockefellers, they used to want to have that responsibility. They wanted their name on all the street corners. They wanted the hospitals named after them and foundations and symphonies and all that stuff. They wanted to have that tie. And Romney is sort of the forefront of this new movement that wants no part of that. They don't want to, they want to be invisible. They want to take out all the value, but they don't need the glory, because with glory comes responsibility. And it's just such a weird mindset. It's just, again, it's hard to wrap your head around. I think that's one of the reasons that people have trouble digesting what it is that he actually did.
Yeah, I mean, and people should think about this. I mean, you're talking about, I think the case of Ampad or KB Toy, you're talking about, you know, supposedly skin in the game that amounts to nothing more than like under 8% of what they, you know, or 10% of what they're.
Or 5%. Yeah.
Yeah,
Ampad was 5%.
I mean,
yeah.
And this is they're almost as it's impossible to have less skin in the game in this scenario. I mean, and not just in terms of the financial stake, but the emotional stake, but the responsibility. I mean, that is really, that's really at the heart of this. Is they are. It's not even like, you know, pirates at least theoretically put themselves in some type of jeopardy, right? I mean,
right.
You got to board that other ship and rape and pillage, but there's a chance you could get shot or hit by a mast, I guess. And in this instance, he's just so detached from all that's going on there. It's played out in his own little boardroom. In fact, you know, it's interesting because that was my understanding in reading about Romney, is that that was the only way that he would take the job of starting Bain Capital, which was
I didn't hear this.
Well, my understanding is that he was working for Bain Company, and as you know, he started Bain Capital, which is the company inside the company.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a story in, forgive me, Mother Jones or Nation, where it talks about how one of the places he raised money was from these right-wing oligarchs in Latin America who were surely associated with paramilitary groups. Now, but out of that story was when he went to take over to start this company, he basically negotiated a situation where there was no risk involved for him. If it fails, he comes back into his old position as if he had remained there and followed the career track so that he would not have, like, lost anything. There was no opportunity cost. And this strikes me the same business model as he approached that. There is no risk for me in this situation.
Right.
I mean, we could lose $5 million, but it seems impossible that they – I mean, I wonder if they ever had a deal in their leverage buyout where they ever lost a dollar.
I don't know. I mean, it is crazy, and it's strange. The funny thing is, I bet they could have done a deal where they literally put nothing down too. But the debt service probably would have been onerously even worse for the takeover target, which is funny because that's exactly the behavior that Mitt Romney himself decried. With all these people who took out subprime mortgages, who didn't put down any money when they bought their houses, he did exactly the same thing. It's exactly identical to one of those subprime mortgages where you put down, 5%, 4%, and the only reason you can do that is because you pay much, much higher debt service after you own the house, and that's what happened to these companies. They paid the cost of Mitt Romney not wanting to put more skin in the game because they had higher debt payments after the takeover. So it's just such a strange thing. And what's so odd about it is that he didn't want the limelight and the responsibility of taking over and managing companies, but he does want to be president, which tells you that he has this very passionate belief in specifically that mindset of we have no responsibility. I mean, you see what I'm saying? Like, it's almost like he wants to spread this gospel of the rich have no obligations, and that's why he's running for president. At least that's the only thing I can figure out. It's
so strange. I mean, it's consistent with everything. I mean, first off, the whole dynamic of loading up these companies with debt is so counterintuitive, like you said, that it's almost like you almost wonder, like, how can society allow this to happen? How could this possibly be legal? Or physics should work this way? And then when you contemplate, here's a guy who has made an extraordinary amount of money. At least we know that he's at least worth $250 million and goes to such great lengths to hide his money. Even though he knows he's running for president. I mean, that's the other sort of, like, it's the extension of that theme. Like, if I'm going to run for president, you would think that inside me, I have this sense of, like, to me, to run for president means, like, I'm going to give something back. I may disagree with Barack Obama on not just the way he's executed certain things, but maybe even ideologically on certain things. But there's no doubt in my mind that he has sort of he thinks that what he's doing is giving back. And I think he probably is, but that's what motivates him. I mean, there's a guy who left, who was the head of the Harvard Law Review, and this would be a very indirect route to enriching yourself, you know, that he has followed. He could have made a tremendous amount of money in just about any endeavor, I think, coming out of Harvard Law School, just like Mitt Romney. But I imagine, like, the idea of, like, I have it in me to run for president, but I just don't have it in me to pay 25% in taxes. I'm just not, you know, I'm not gonna go that far to pay, you know, to give the country, you know, to keep. I'm not gonna be happy if I only have $225 million and the other $25 million goes to America. That's a little too much. I mean, I think there's something just so deep and demented inside this guy. And now,
absolutely.
When during his convention speech, where he says, like, I could have gone back to Michigan. And I loved cars, and I could have been a car guy, but I said, no, I need to strike out on my own. I'm like reinterpreting that moment now in the context of just how much he didn't want to be involved in something that was in any way showed any benefit outside of like his small circle where his pals are sitting there with money sticking out of their pockets and ears in that picture.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's funny. I think, I mean, that's such a funny description. It makes absolutely no sense to think about him wanting the massive responsibility of running for the president of the United States if he didn't even want to pay the same tax rate as a firefighter or go into the car business, which like his dad did. You know, this is vital, essential part of our economy. He wanted nothing to do with that.
Right, and particularly then, I mean, car business, I mean, car company, you know, I mean, how many other industries can we say, as GM does, so does the country, right? I mean,
right.
I mean, has there ever been a single industry more associated with America than the car business?
Nope, and he didn't want any part of that. So it doesn't make any sense. Unless you think of him almost as like a Manchurian candidate who's running to advance this, you know, the agenda of this other crazy group of people who, you know, the super rich, you know, sect of society that wants essentially to secede from the United States. And set up rules that make it more advantageous for them to do that. You know, they want to be, you know, cut off from and their relationship to the rest of the country. They want their part of the world to not be connected to, you know, the ghettos and those shuttered factory towns and all those horrible places. And I think Mitt Romney's the guy who's going to speed that transition by writing the rules that makes it easier for them to have that kind of society within a society. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. I just can't see him.
Never underestimate the power of father hate, because in my alternate universe explanation, you know, when Mitt Romney won the when Mitt Romney was in danger of losing the nomination to Rick Santorum at one point, I can't remember exactly when this was, but he got up there and he said, I am going to win this nomination. And it was a moment where he was going, where you would expect him to say, I'm going to be the president of the United States. But he didn't.
Right.
He said, I'm going to win this nomination. And frankly, I'm not convinced that this isn't just about, I know Dad never thought money was that big of a deal, but I'm not only going to make more money than him, I'm going to be the nominee where he never got there. And I would not surprise me whatsoever, you know, that that's what it's about for this guy. But again, at the end of the day, my big lament is that we are not seeing the Democrats go directly at this. I mean, they've talked about Bain, they've talked about his taxes, but they're not going to the heart of what is really problematic with this sense of with capitalism as we know it today, one where it's all about not investing in the capital of America in some respect, in the narrow sense of I'm going to make money but also, you know, plow it back into investing into this country. It's just, I'm going to extract. I'm just going to extract the wealth and walk away with it. And, you know, that's what was so annoying to me about the convention last night with guys like Cory Booker, who were like, who were just so vocal about protecting
private equity.
Just give me a break.
Yeah, and it's incredibly short-sighted, I think, especially given the way that Wall Street hasn't coughed up the money to the Democrats in this election cycle.
Right.
I mean, what else? Forget about the fact that it's the right thing to do to tell the country what's actually going on and why nobody has a good manufacturing job anymore, and forget about telling them exactly what their opponent did for a living to make his money to prepare for his presidential run. It's just not even smart from a political point of view to not expose all of these terrible secrets, because they're not even getting the money anymore. I mean, they're clearly, the reason they're not doing it is because they clearly don't want to be on the wrong side of companies like KKR and the Carlyle Group, and, you know, Thomas Lee and all these other massive campaign contributors who historically have given a lot of money to the Democrats. So for fear of alienating them, they're not making any criticisms at all of the business as a whole, and they're limiting themselves to what Bain did specifically, which makes their criticisms totally incoherent.
Yeah.
Because unless you put them in the context of what the business is generally, it's impossible to explain, you know, what exactly it is that's so wrong about the way he made his money. So I just think it's a terrible political calculation in addition to being cowardly and the wrong thing to do. I agree,
but I would even go a step farther, because I think, you know, for a guy like Cory Booker, it's not necessarily a bad political calculation, because he's not running in this election, and he has certainly relied on these type of people for his own particular campaigns. And I would also say that I think to a certain extent, it's also just simply a mindset. It's just like, look, maybe what they do, you know, we're all at the same club, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yes, maybe these guys aren't helping me out this time, but when we, you know, metaphorically I'm speaking now, but when we get to the club, I don't want to ruin dinner. And I don't have to be sitting at dinner and thinking like, oh, there's George over there looking at me. He's mad at me. I don't want that. I want to be able to go to the club and relax. And, you know, I don't want to be, you know, worried that, you know, we're at the pool and, you know, we're not going to get the good chair. You know, I think it's just a part of, I think it's just a sensibility that they have. Like, we just don't do that. It's just not what, you know, the aristocrats just don't, they don't do that to each other.
Right. I just think the delusion there is that they're really part of the club, though. I think that most of these people think of governments and people who work in government as the help, basically.
Yeah.
They'll let them hang around, they'll let them come to meetings, and but they're not really part of it, you know? And so I think there's a social climbing aspect to it that makes it even more nauseating. But anyway, but you're exactly right. And I say this obviously in a self-interested way because I wrote this article. But they should be hammering this very point.
Absolutely.
In this convention, it's a game winner. All you have to do is say this is the guy who wrecked companies by forcing them to take on debt. And that's it. It's over. But they don't want to do it.
Yeah, and they don't even have to produce any video for this. They can borrow Newt Gingrich's. I mean, honestly, that they're not just running that at their convention is mind-blowing. I mean, you know, go grab it off of YouTube, take the copy that your cousin stole or whatever it is, and put it up on the screen and let them sue you. You know, it's unbelievable. But Matt Taibbi, I cannot recommend this piece enough to people because it's just it's so simple, but it's almost just so unbelievable It's breathtaking to me. The piece is in this coming edition of Rolling Stone, and it's also available, of course, online at rollingstone.com. Matt Taibbi, always a pleasure. Now I got to go take some, like, blood pressure pills or something.
All right, Sam. Sorry for hiding from the phone, man. I really do apologize.
People don't even notice. I mean, most people won't even notice because we'll just shorten up that time. But the people who were listening live had an extremely long musical break.
All right, man. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks again. I appreciate it. All right, folks. I mean, I got out some of the stuff I want to say about the convention, obviously, in the course, but that it's along those themes. And I've got some very positive things to say about last night, but they tend to deal with sort of the execution of last night, as opposed to giving you good news about what it says, where the Democrats are headed. You know, what do you want me to do? You know, what do you want out of a guy? All right. It's not like I don't have, issues of my own. Dara woke me up at 6 a.m. tonight. You know, that's the thing, is I stay up now, you know, until I watch the convention till 11. Convention ends at 11. Then I watch the recaps of the convention. Then I tweet about the convention. And then all of a sudden it's 12:30. And I gotta try and go to bed. It's playing through my head all the things that have aggravated me, because, you know, you spend this long, you think so intensely about what these mean, you can't just go right to bed. And then my kid wakes me up at 6 in the morning, because she's excited, because her grandpa's coming to town. And right now she's probably getting ready to go see Newsies. All right, I'm rambling now. Folks, please become a member of the Majority Report. And now, if you ever, look, I'd like you to become a member to support the show, the free show. So you get a 40-minute interview with Matt Taibbi. You know where else you can get that? Nowhere. Nowhere else. And any other host would have stopped trying to call him back after the first 4 minutes of trying to call him. But I know. I know that what happens with Taibbi. I don't know what goes on there around the phone, but I know. And so please become a member to support the show. But if you're one of those people who's like, you know what? I'm like Mitt Romney. I'm like Paul Ryan. If Oliver Twist came up to me and said, please serve some more, I go, I don't know. You don't look that thin to me. If you're one of those people, the penny pinchers or the, you know, I want to make sure I get value, now is your opportunity. Because strangeangels.com, which is where I would be if I wasn't, otherwise occupied in terms of being married. Strangeangels.com, to support the program, has said that if there are people out there who want to sample the better half of the program, phone calls, IMs, more stories, they can send an email to majorityreporters@gmail.com, put the words Strange Angels in the subject line, and you will get a one-month free trial membership courtesy of strangeangels.com. All right, folks. Obviously, you can also support justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, organic. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link. Tomorrow on the program, I don't know, I may try and get Jack Hitt and Kevin Baker to come back on, see if their phone reception is better in Charlotte. Also, Dean Abadella will be here, talk about his, he's doing his Muslim comedy tour. I don't know who else we will have. All right, folks, see you in the better half.